Well, good morning, church. Good to see each of you here this morning. If you're looking around and you're saying, I'm wondering where so-and-so is. I thought I was missing them in the first service or the second service, and I was looking where they are. They might be over in the FLC. Each week, we're going to have two of our deacon care groups that are going to be meeting over in the FLC. So I don't know the numbers over there this morning, but if you're looking around, you're kind of wondering where some people are. That'll be the case, and that group will rotate over there. So hello to you guys over in the FLC as well. I want to invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 37. We're going to begin a series this morning that on the life of a man in the Old Testament by the name of Joseph. And the title of this series is Overcoming Life's Challenges. I don't know if many people who face more challenging times in their life than Joseph. We're going to see some of this morning, but he had a dysfunctional family. He experienced intense temptation. He had some life-pounding disappointments that we're going to see kind of continually through his life. I mean, his life was a series of dead ends, sort of one after another. I've been doing some reading and some studying on Joseph's life for a few weeks now, and when I first sat down to write down some notes, this was my first comment in my notes. If there was ever somebody who had an excuse not to make it, it was Joseph. We kind of think about Joseph's life as a life of tremendous victory, and it is. We're going to get there, but it started off and actually continued throughout with a lot of turmoil and a lot of challenges. We're going to find out why I think this is true here this morning. I do want you to know, we're going to get to this at the end, and then we're going to see it through the rest of the book, that Joseph's life is not some sad saga of woe. You don't ever read Joseph feeling sorry for himself. You never hear him saying, man, it's too bad I didn't have a better start in life. If things had just started off better, then maybe things would be okay for me. But it's not a story like that. But it is a story of overcoming life's challenges. And that's why the title is what it is. So what we're going to do, we've got this little window here this morning. I'm going to be gone for a little bit of vacation. We have some other things. But we have got like 5 weeks throughout this summer. And I'm really going to ask you to kind of buckle up this morning in that series of 5 weeks. That's what we're going to do. 5 weeks in the life of Joseph, and in that time, we're going to have sort of this thrilling journey, I hope, for each of us through his life and some of the things that we can learn from that. In fact, I'm very confident that Joseph's life will speak to you at some point that is unusually meaningful in your life. It might be this morning. I hope Joseph's life speaks to you, but I think it's going to speak to you in an unusually meaningful way at some point along in this series, and you're going to learn some lessons. I hope we learn some lessons together about overcoming life's challenges. So right now, here's the five titles. I reserve the right to change these at any time, but as I look at them right now, here's the five titles, and I think they'll be interesting for you. This week, overcoming rejection. We're going to talk about overcoming temptation. Part three will be overcoming disappointment, overcoming success, and then overcoming bitterness. And if you look at that list and you say, boy, that seems a little negative, Joseph's life is far from negative. And so I'm going to subtitle them with a little bit more of a positive take. And here they are, the power of courage and the power of character and the power of trust and hope and the power of integrity and the power of forgiveness. You look down that list, and I hope that you can look through over the course of this summer and see that I really expect that God's going to do some amazing things in our life as we just work down through this incredible, incredible story of the life of Joseph. Well, we need to get into our text. We got a long way to go this morning. We're going to try to set the stage both for sort of the lessons at the end of this one, but for some of the lessons to come. I want to introduce you to the main players, and we're going to do that in Genesis chapter 37. Let's begin reading in verse 1. We'll read a few verses and then we'll come back as we go through this morning. Bible says this, "And Joseph dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. We're going to introduce you to them in just a minute. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. So Joseph comes back and tells his father a bad report, gives his father a bad report of his brothers. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. I don't know if you noticed it, but these verses describe a situation that's like a giant powder keg. You know what that analogy means? It's sort of, you know, the gunpowder is already sitting there, and all it needs is a spark. All it needs is a little flame, and the whole thing is going to blow up. Have you ever been in somebody's home where the minute that you walk in, you can sort of feel the tension that's going across the home? They don't even have to say any words. It's almost like, you know, maybe mom and dad, they're staring daggers at each other, and their body language is there's just a tenseness into that home. And that relationship usually has spillover. And oftentimes in that kind of a setting, when mom or dad are in that setting, then the spillover is that the kids act as if they can't stand each other. Let me tell you, that's exactly what we just walked into in Genesis 37. We have an explosive atmosphere just waiting for the spark. It's just waiting to blow the top off. In today's terms, we'd call this a dysfunctional family. Joseph grew up in what we call kind of the epitome of a dysfunctional family. And I want you to notice that there's some reasons for this explosive situation. Dysfunctional families don't just happen. If you're taking notes, I want to give you the background. These first four things are sort of the background for principle number one before we come back to that principle. But I want you to see four points of potential combustion in this family, all right? Four things that have the potential to spark this powder keg and blow it up, and eventually we're going to see that. Point number one is this: deception, manipulation, and self-interest was the name of the game. To really understand Joseph's life, we're going to have to get an overview of the situation leading up to his birth. In fact, this morning, that's why I'm going to try to move quick. I'm going to ask you to buckle up because we're going to try to give an overview of Genesis 25 through 37. All right, we're just going to pick out a few verses, and you're going to have to track with me. I'm going to ask you to read a lot of verses in different sections, and I'll try to put the pieces together. But in reading these different sections, they're going to give you an understanding of what was going on in Joseph's life that you may not have really seen before as you thought about him. So in order to understand his life, we have to go way back to Joseph's father, a man by the name of Jacob. And we're going to pick up his story in Genesis 25. If you look at Genesis 25 and read a couple of verses starting in verse 20. So Isaac, you might remember, is the son of who? Abraham. Abraham's son Isaac, and Isaac is going to have two sons. We're going to find this in a minute. So Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram. I'd say it that way. That's a cool name, by the way. How'd you like to be from Padan Aram? All right. The sister to Laban, the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. She didn't have any children. And the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Go down to verse 24. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, all over like an hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. And the boys grew, And Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And if you just read that last two verses, probably everybody in here says, we got trouble happening here, right? And it's not just because of this sort of division of the parents and the love that's divided among the kids. I mean, even back as far as Jacob's name means deceiver. I mean, how'd you like to be named deceiver or conniver or manipulator? That's his name. And in fact, that is ultimately the story of his life that's going to affect him for some generations to come. So we see it right from the very beginning in this chapter, the end of, I'm not going to read these verses, but the end of chapter 25, Jacob manipulates his brother Esau into selling his birthright. You might remember that. And then a couple of chapters later in chapter 27, Jacob and his mother Rebekah manipulate Jacob's father Isaac into giving Jacob the blessing that was reserved for the firstborn. And you can read that in chapter 27. And you just keep reading. And in their story of this family, I mean, you just have manipulation and deceit and a kind of a struggle that's happening on an ongoing problem with this family. And listen, if I can just stop to say, if you have self-interest and manipulation and deception going on in your family, then you're in for trouble. Because this stuff has a horrible way of passing from generation to generation. And you may not even realize it, but we're going to see this happening. Manipulation and deceit that happen from one generation to another, where using people and using things and manipulating circumstances and sort of emotional outbursts to kind of get your way. Are you tracking with me? Anger and sadness and clamming up. I mean, there's all kinds of different ways we use the circumstances and our emotions to try to get what we want inside our relationships, inside of our families. But listen, it has a devastating impact on the family. And we're going to see it play out here. Now hang on, because it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to pass from generation to generation. If you're sitting here and you're like, man, that is like the family that I grew up in. I'm trying to honor my mom. I'm trying to honor my dad. But this is sort of the story of our family. I mean, kind of woe is me. This happens. It has to happen generation to generation. So no, it doesn't have to pass from generation to generation. But if it doesn't, we're going to have to break the cycle. Right? We're going to talk about that. So not only that, deception, manipulation, self-interest was the name of the game in this family, but number two, the biblical pattern for marriage was ignored. And this is so foundational. I want to stop for a minute on it to describe what happens here in Jacob's life, in Joseph's family, and some applications. But I want you to get this. It has never been in God's ideal plan for a man to marry more than one woman. It always leads to trouble. We see it in life. We see it all throughout the Bible. Genesis chapter 2, at the very beginning, God gives us a pattern for families and a pattern for marriage. And it's the pattern is one man and one woman for life. And it's for our good. It's for the good of our families. But Jacob ignored God's pattern. In fact, we see it all in chapters 29 and 30, and I'm not going to read them, but can I just give you an overview of what happens here in chapters 29 and 30? I've got a little picture for you, and I'm going to try to circle a few things in here. And I can't put the whole story together. We don't have time this morning, but you can go back and read it in chapters 29 and 30. But Jacob loved Rachel, and he worked for 7 years in order to try to win and receive Rachel as his bride. And you might remember this story. On the night of their wedding, his father-in-law, Laban, switched the girls, and instead of marrying Rachel, Jacob ended up marrying Leah. And Leah was the older and less attractive. I mean, the Bible's pretty clear about this, less attractive of the two sisters. And there's a sad story that comes as a result of Laban's deceit in this situation. But Jacob stays and he continues to work for another 7 years, and then he also marries Rachel. Leah has four sons. And Rachel is jealous of the fact that Leah has been given four sons, and so she gives her servant Bilhah to Jacob as another wife, and Bilhah bears to Jacob two more sons. Leah now is jealous. She's, at least at this point, done having children, so she's jealous that Rachel is giving sons through her servant to Jacob, and so she gives her servant Zilpah to Jacob, and Zilpah then bears two more sons. Leah then has children. She has two more children after that, and so she has Issachar and Zebulun. And then after all of that situation happening, Rachel then does bear a son, and that's Joseph. This is what we're getting to, right? We're telling Joseph's story. In fact, I want you to read a couple of verses about Joseph. Go to chapter 30. All of that story I just told you very quickly happens in Genesis 29 and 30. But look in chapter 30 and verse 22 says this: "And God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her and opened her womb, and she conceived and bare a son and said, 'God hath taken away my reproach.' And she called his name Joseph and said, 'The Lord shall add to me another son.'" If you read this story, I mean, it's a tragic story in the beginning. In fact, I kind of skipped over this, but if you go back to the end of chapter 29, and you'll see the last few verses, some of the heartache that's happening in Leah's life because of the fact that Joseph didn't love her. She bore children with the hope that Joseph would love her, and he didn't. So finally, in chapter 30, Leah has a child, and his name is Joseph. And then to finish this whole story of the children, jump over to chapter 35, chapter 35 and verse 16. So it says this: "They journeyed from Bethel," hang on to that because they're moving, the family's moving. "They journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath, and Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. And it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said unto her, 'Fear not, thou shalt have this son also.'" This is her second son. "And it came to pass as her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin." Verse 19, "And Rachel died and was buried in the way of Ephrath, which is in Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar upon her grave." That is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this day. Listen, this whole story, this is how we're introduced to Joseph in chapter 37. Can I summarize it for you with this? Listen very carefully because I think it's moving. Here's how we're introduced to Joseph in the verses that we read in chapter 37, when we said Joseph was, he's 17 years old. His mom had just passed away 1 year ago, and he had a baby brother. His dad was grieving, and he was grieving the loss of his mother and Jacob's love of his life. They were in a new location. He had three stepmothers. His mom had passed away, but he had three stepmothers. He had 10 stepbrothers and a stepsister all living in the same home at the same time. His aunt Leah, or his stepmom Leah, same person, hated his mom and resented the attention that his dad gave to him and his brother. His stepbrothers despised him. Just try to imagine the turmoil in this family. I mean, you can't make it up. You talk about a dysfunctional situation. This is the place where Joseph grew up. And we're not done with the bad news. But I want to just make this note. A big part of the friction in this family was a result of Jacob ignoring, for whatever reason, God's intention for one man and one woman for life. I mean, that's really the chaos that this created. And you can mark this down. I want to say this gently, but I want to say it clearly on the basis of the scriptures. Any breakdown in the husband-wife relationship has serious spillover effects on all the relationships in the home. Dads and mom, you have to guard, you have to protect your marriage. Protect your marriage at all costs. If you wonder why, when you're having conflict in your marriage, your kids start to act up, because our kids know inherently that if something happens between these two people who mean the world to me, my whole world's going to collapse. They know that. The biblical pattern for marriage was ignored, but that's not it. Confession point number three is this. Parental passiveness took the place of godly parental leadership. And I'm talking about Jacob, the father in particular, and we see this in two instances in these chapters, and I want to talk about at least these two instances. Chapter 34, if you want to look there, I'm not going to read a lot of it, but I'm going to read a couple verses. In chapter 34, we have a horrible story that just churns your heart. Dinah, Leah's daughter, Jacob's daughter, is raped in this chapter 34. In fact, verse 5 says this, "And Jacob heard that he," this is a guy named Shechem, "that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were home." And the question that I ask is, why did he remain quiet? Why did he hold his peace? Frankly, I don't think I would have waited for the sons to come home. I don't know any other dads here. I'm not suggesting that we take matters necessarily into our own hands, but something needed to be done in this situation. And I think it's telling when the scripture says, this happened to his daughter, and Jacob said, I'm going to just wait till my boys to come home. And the fact that he didn't take any leadership, I want you to look what happened. Look at verse 7. "And the sons of Jacob came out of the field, and when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth," they were very angry, because he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. So the boys come home, and now they're mad. Jacob was pretty passive about the situation. The dad, can you imagine that, was passive about what had happened to his daughter, but the brothers come home, and they're mad. So they make an agreement, manipulation, deceit, the agreement with the men of Shechem that they would allow their sister to marry Shechem if all the men would consent to be circumcised. You can read this story in Genesis 34. And the men of Shechem, the Shechemites, agreed, and when they were physically recovering from the circumcision, the brothers went in and killed them all. I'm not condoning the retaliation, but my question is this. Where was dad? Where was dad when this family needed leadership because of a tragedy that happened in their home? Where was dad? And I just want to say, dad, you need to take some leadership. I'd like to reach out to Jacob and say, man, you got a daughter that's been violated. And you got some sons that are out of control. And all this time, dad, where were you? What was so involved in your life that you just let these kinds of things happen in your family? I don't mean to be too harsh on Jacob, but he finally shows up in the picture down in chapter 30 and verse 30 and 31. After he let this happen, after he passively let this happen, both what happened to his daughter and then his response of his sons without providing them any leadership, now he's going to step into the picture and listen to what he says. He says, "And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi," his oldest sons that really led in trying to take care of this problem that dad wouldn't take care of. Now he says to them, you have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. For I, being few in number, we don't have many people, and we're in a land that's, you know, greatly outnumbers us. For I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, listen to what the son say to the father, should he deal with our sister who is with an harlot? It's a pretty strong situation. It's a pretty strong conversation. They're saying, Dad, where were you? Where were you when something should have happened to protect our sister? What were you doing? And when it did happen, how come you weren't there to lead us and how to handle the situation in the right way? Someone needed to take control and evidence some leadership. Someone needed to be the protector and the leader of this family. And Dad, that's your job. Your family's counting on you. Instance number two is found in chapter 35, if you want to look at chapter 35. Reuben, the oldest son, had a sexual relation with Bilhah, the mother of two of his half-brothers and Jacob's wife. We'd call this incest. If you can imagine how destructive this was to the family situation. And the amazing thing about this is this. Look at verse 22. This is Genesis 35 and verse 22. And it came to pass that when Israel dwelt in that land, Israel's another name for Jacob, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel, Jacob, heard it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. That's it. And Israel, Jacob, heard about it, but we don't have anything that he did about it. His son violated the trust and the incestual relationship in the family. Jacob heard about it, but as far as we know, he didn't do anything about it. In fact, I think it's almost pointed to say now he just goes on. Now, the sons. I mean, it's just like he just went on. Jacob was such a passive father that when he heard that his son had done, he did absolutely nothing about it. Nothing as far as we know. Later on, in fact, years later, Jacob talked about this, and he still, years later, he's bitter about it, but he didn't do anything in the instance. Go to chapter 49. Genesis chapter 49. Thanks for hanging in with me. This is all so important for what we're talking about here. 49 and verse 3. This is Jacob speaking now. He says, Reuben, he's talking to Reuben. You are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. But he says, you are unstable as water. Thou shalt not excel because thou wentest up to thy father's bed. Then defilest thou it. He went up to my couch. How many years later? Jacob is bitter about it now, but he didn't do anything about it in the middle of the situation. If you're like me, look at these stories and you say, why didn't you deal with it at the time? Why didn't you get involved in your children's lives? Were you just too busy? Were you just too self-centered? Just too afraid of what people might think? But and no matter what, dads, I want to implore you, passive fathering is out. You have to be involved. I don't care if your dad was uninvolved and you don't know what it means for a dad to be involved. It doesn't matter. I understand, but it's not okay. You can't be a passive father. It doesn't matter if you've been passive in the past, maybe because that's a little bit of how you've seen families do it before. You don't know what it means to kind of be an active and involved father. Now you're looking at it and you're like, hey, you know, my kids are kind of growing up. I've kind of had this. I'm just saying, do it now. Get involved now. Correct them now. Put up the appropriate hedges of protection and do it now. Encourage them now. You cannot leave it up to mom. This cannot be mom's job in the home. Your children and your family, they need your leadership. Combustion point number four is this. The jealousy and anger and hatred were fostered and then allowed to simmer. I'm going to get you back to Genesis 37. I know I started there and we got to talk about Joseph's life here in 37, but all of that is background. That's kind of the context around this. So Genesis 37, let me read this story. Verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. They couldn't even say a kind word to him. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed, for behold, we are binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose, and all stood upright, and behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf." All of your sheaves bowed down to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or will you indeed have dominion over us?" And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream, and he told it to his brethren and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow down ourselves to you, to the earth?" And his brethren envied him. But his father observed the saying. There's a lot of stuff in here. His brothers despised Joseph. I mean, it comes out of this dysfunctional family that we just described, but his brothers hated him. In fact, the word hate is used three times in the first 4, 5, and 8, all of them talk about their hatred for Joseph. In fact, so much so that verse 4 says they couldn't even speak a kind word to him. How'd you like to grow up in a family like that? 11 brothers, 10 brothers, not one of them could even say a kind word to you. You're hated by each one. From the time you were 1 year old, your mom had passed away and you lived with three stepmothers who hated you as well. Leah hated your mom, and the fact that your dad gave favor to you and your brother just made them all. This kind of hatred and this kind of jealousy is catastrophic to any family, and it was just simmering in this family. It's just seething here in Joseph's family. Thanks for staying with me here through these details. I know they're kind of intense. And I knew coming into this that it would be intense. This is the story. I've just told the story and what was going on within this family. I don't know that we'd really be able to understand, you know, kind of what's going on with the deception and the anger and this rivalry and this out of control jealousy that was so rampant within the ranks of this family of boys. But this is Joseph's life. This is the home that he grew up in. It's a pretty hard place to grow up as a young boy. And by the way, Joseph wasn't perfect. In fact, as I read through this, I think he made some big mistakes. I think he had a lot of stuff going on in his own character development. I realize that he was young, and we're going to see God breaking him down in the coming scriptures, but I mean, telling these dreams, I mean, we just know it. He's asking for trouble. In fact, one commentator said this. He said, Joseph was destined for great things, but he also had grand weaknesses and big ego to overcome. Craving his brother's attention, acceptance, and affection, he appeared where he was not invited, said what nobody wanted to hear, flaunted what no one else had, from father's favors to heavenly visions. The young upstart often made a big fuss about his dreams, wore his loud, colorful, and exclusive coat everywhere, and got on everyone's nerves, everyone's case, and everyone's blacklist. He was not wise, likable, or tolerable. In short, he was a spoiled brat and a little monster, a pet to his father, but a rat, a mole, and a pest to his brothers. I think that's probably how they felt about it. It's kind of like the construction worker who took his lunch out and exclaimed, "Bologna sandwiches again! I'm so sick of bologna sandwiches! If I see another one, I'll just die." And his co-worker said, "Well, why don't you ask your wife to pack something else for your lunch?" And he replied, "I'm not married. I pack my own lunch. I don't need your sympathy jokes for that, because listen to this. The moral of the story is this. Some of the bologna in our lives we put there ourselves." True? Right? This is part of Joseph's story. He had a horrible family. And who would question some of the ways that he grew up, but some of the mess was his own. And all of that gets us to principle number one. These will be quick, but I want to tell you a couple things. Number one, realize that God's plan is to change and prepare us for service, no matter what our family background may look like. All right, we're changing the tone here. The reality of where Joseph comes from, we have to see, but I'm telling you, God's doing something here, and it's going to be incredible. If there was ever somebody who had an excuse not to make it, it was Joseph. There's no question that he was impacted by the sins of his family, spanning several generations. But the truth is that God was going to use all of this. I mean, all of this is part of God's plan, and we see it unfolding even now. And Joseph, he didn't blame anybody. As far as we know, he didn't get bogged down in self-pity. And, you know, he didn't just accept the sin patterns in his own life. He didn't just say, "Well, this is just the way I am. This is just the family that I grew up with. I'm just a product of my environment." He didn't accept the manipulation and the deceit and kind of said, "Well, I can't help myself. This is just how I grew up." No, God had big plans for Joseph, and he's going to pick him up out of this simmering, sort of bickering, jealousy-filled family. And we're going to read about how God is going to do that in just a minute. At 17 years old, where we pick up this story, Joseph's life is going to change. I want you to know this morning that if you see some similarities in your family background, and there's a lot of us in here that are going to know that, you're going to feel these things that we've been talking about this morning, and if you see some similarities in your family background to what Joseph went through, the fact that you're here this morning tells me this: God has some different plans for you. He wants to change you. He wants to conform you. He wants to prepare you to serve Him. So don't feel sorry for yourself. Don't play the blame game. This morning, just do what I think Joseph's going to do. You can just say, "Okay, God, what do you want? What do I need to change? Point out the habits of my life that maybe have come from generations in my past. Help me not to repeat the same mistakes in my family. Help me to break the cycle." God can do this. He wants to do this. And the fact that you're here this morning listening to this, and I hope that you'll stay through this series, is God's voice in your life saying, "This is what I want to do for you right now." Here's number two. Realize that spiritual character is developed in the classroom of life circumstances, and they're often difficult. We just said that God had big plans for Joseph. He is going to pick him up out of that simmering, bickering, jealousy-filled family. He's going to take him up out of that. I'm guessing Joseph really had no idea. He never would have imagined just how God was going to do this. I mean, at 17 years old, all Joseph probably knew is my life is going to be a wreck. Let's tell the story real quick. How did this happen? We're in chapter 37. Look at verse 12. Just read a couple verses here. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel, Jacob, said unto Joseph, do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said unto him, here I am. And he said to him, go, I pray you, see whether it'll be well with your brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him, Joseph, out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Go down to verse 18. And when they, his brothers, saw him, Joseph, afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said to one another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say, some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and he said, let's not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that's in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father. Again, are you kind of tracking the story? Joseph's coming to the field. The brothers see him afar off. They say, we're finally going to get rid of this dreamer. See what's going to happen to his dreams now. Ha, we're going to bow down to him. We're going to take care of him. When he comes, we're going to kill him. He's 17 years old. We're going to kill him. Tell our dad that a wild beast ate, you know, took care of him. And Reuben steps in and says, no, let's not kill him. Let's put him in the pit. I just said that spiritual character is developed in the classrooms of life circumstances, and they're often difficult. Joseph, at 17 years old, I think, is about to go to school, the classroom. And I'm sure that all this time, Joseph is thinking, you know, the brothers do this. I mean, they lay out this plan. They grab him, they put him in the pit, and we're going to get the whole rest of the story. And I can just imagine Joseph's like, God, why would you allow this to happen to me? I mean, I've had a lot of bad stuff happen already, and now this? My brothers hate me, now this? And I just want to tell you that even in this, what seems humanly like such a horrible situation, that God knew what He was doing. He had these plans for Joseph's life, and ultimately His plans to preserve His family that was God's people. But in order for Joseph to be used of God in the way that ultimately he's going to be used, he was going to have to develop some character that I don't think he had yet. And it seems to me, as I look through the Bible, we find this to be true, although you might not like it, but God develops character in our lives by putting us in tough circumstances. I mean, this is, I don't like it, you don't like it, but it's the truth. This is how it happens over and over again. David said, when I'm tried and purified, I shall come forth as gold. When God puts me through the fire, that's when He's going to, you know, conform me and conform my life. I've told you this before. I hope that it's something that you remember, but God's far more concerned with our character than He is with our comfort. And none of us really like that. We kind of like God to be helping me out in the comfort area a little bit more. But all throughout the Bible, I mean, this is true. God's trying to conform us so that He can use us. And He almost always does this by bringing some tough circumstances into our lives. I think that's what's happening here with Joseph. So in your own life, you know, when you have conflict, I'm guessing there's a lot of people in here, you got some conflict going on in your life. And you have disappointments, and you go through difficulties, and you face temptations, and you have times of dryness in your life, and you have delays where you're really hoping God would move forward, and in fact, He's telling you to wait. Listen, God is in the process of shaping you and molding you, and you got to just trust Him. My brothers, I'm the youngest. I have three older brothers, and every time I complained about something when I was growing up that was difficult, they always said to me, hey, it's building character. I learned to hate those words. And there's still sometimes when, in fact, not sometimes, probably every time when I really don't like the character building process in my life. I'm sure you don't either. But it is how God builds us. Romans chapter 8 says, we know that all things work together for good in order to, that He would like to conform us into the image of His Son. 1 Peter chapter 1 says that we should greatly rejoice, though now for a season, that we're in heaviness through manifold temptation, some really hard things in our lives. But He said that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. The trial of your faith, God's going to use it in shaping you. James chapter 1 says, know this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have her perfect work. Let God do the work that He's trying to do when He's trying your faith, in order that you would be complete and entire, wanting nothing. God is using difficult circumstances in our lives, believers, in order to help to shape us. And here's the third principle from this text. That's this: realize that God is omniscient when your understanding is incomplete. No matter how dark the days may seem, I got a pretty good feeling that there are some dark days as Joseph is bound and then drugged to Egypt's slave block. This is the picture. I don't know how long it took to get from where they were to the slavery block there in Egypt, but I think there's some pretty dark days in Joseph's perspective. And there's going to be some more dark days to come. I mean, this isn't going to be the end of it. We're going to have some prison time and some extended prison time and some false accusations. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's still to come in Joseph's life. I got to imagine in the middle of those, he was wondering, God, what are you doing? But what the Bible says is that God always, He always works for your good and for your best. So this morning, I just want to tell you and make this clear. If you're a Christian, God is working in His plan for your life. God sees the big picture. So whatever the disappointments are, whatever the discouragements are right now, God sees it and He's working in all of these things for your good, just like He was in Joseph's life. He doesn't see it yet, and you might not see it yet. You might not see it today. Joseph doesn't yet. But we know that God is working. He's in the process of taking these life circumstances and He's shaping and molding and fashioning us and shaping our character so that He would be able to use us. I realize that there's some that we're talking to here this morning and you know the pain of rejection. I think that's the main takeaway from this morning. No matter what mistakes Joseph made, no matter what circumstances he came from, Joseph grew up knowing and experiencing rejection from his stepmom and stepmoms, from his brothers day in and day out, until ultimately this ultimate rejection when they hated him enough that they were willing to sell him as a slave. I know that there's some here that you've faced some rejection, maybe from a dysfunctional home, and you've experienced the rejection from your parents or your brothers or your sisters. Maybe your rejection was from a spouse or from a son or from a daughter. You're sitting here this morning and all the weight of that whole situation just seems to be sitting on your shoulders, and you say, what do I do? What do I do with this sense that I just feel of the rejection of these people in my life? First of all, let me tell you that you need to connect with God. It's interesting, I don't have time to talk about this obviously, but it's interesting, in this first chapter, there's no mention of God at all in this passage. We don't want to read too much into this because when we get another couple chapters down the road in 39 verse 2, it says that God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph during this time. But we don't have any reference to God in chapter 37, what we're reading here. And here's what I think. This might be a little bit of conjecture, but here's what I think. I just wonder if Joseph didn't connect with God there on that long road to Egypt. Seems like he was making some pretty bad choices up till then. Doesn't seem like he was really led by God's Spirit and his character was being shaped a lot by God. I mean, he was seeing visions, but man, some of the ways that he was living it out, I know we don't have any reference to God in there. We're going to find reference to God a lot as we move forward, and I wonder if it was on that road when Joseph was broken that God stepped into his life and he connected on that path to Egypt. Maybe that's what you need to do this morning. Maybe your road to Egypt is sort of right now, maybe even in this place. God's as if he's reaching down to you in the middle of your dysfunction, in the middle of the rejection that you've faced, and maybe some of the decisions that you've made that have created some of it. Maybe this morning God is reaching down with his ever-present faithful love and he's calling to you and you know that you need to connect with God today and in your life. If you're a Christian here and you are connected with God, how do you face and overcome rejection? I think these three things will help you. They're from the life of Joseph. Realize that God's plan is to change and prepare us for service, no matter what our family background may look like. Realize that spiritual character is developed in the classroom of life circumstances, and they're often difficult. And realize that God is omniscient. He knows it all, even when your understanding is incomplete.